Well, then, I would like to start this evening by introducing to you, for those of you who don't know him, the Buddha image on the altar. This lump of bronze is cast into the shape of what is known as Buddha calling earth to witness, touching the earth. And it is a depiction of the moment of the Buddha's enlightenment, okay, and of the form of the final internal struggle that he was undergoing leading up to the moment of his enlightenment. And if you've had a chance to study any of the sort of Theravada Buddhist psychology, you know that there's this formulation of different personality types. The greedy type, the deluded type, and the aversive type. Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, had a world-class aversive personality. Okay. He ravaged his body for off and on for about 6 years, trying to get rid it of the desires that he thought were getting in the way of his becoming enlightened. And even when he realized that all I was doing was committing slow suicide, then maybe there was a better way. Still in all, as he was approaching the moment of enlightenment, he was assailed by extraordinary doubt. And the thought arose, and he did kind of a gestalt thing when he was telling the story later on. He would conjure up this persona that gave voice to what was going on in his mind, who he called Mara. And he said that leading up to the moment of enlightenment, the final and perhaps in some ways the most powerful obstacle was this voice that arose in him that said, "Who do you think you are? By what authority do you claim to be an enlightened being? By what authority do you claim to be able to teach this Dharma?" And in touching the earth, the gesture the Buddha was actually making was to say, by the authority vested in me and all sentient beings and the earth itself. Because his teaching was for the benefit of all sentient beings, for the awakening of all sentient beings, for the protection of all sentient beings. So if you ever have an opportunity to visit certainly a Tibetan monastery or anywhere in Asia, you'll see that there's this great image of the Dharma wheel. Okay, and on either side are two deer, and the two deer are smiling. Okay. And this is a reminder of the first Dharma talk, public Dharma talk the Buddha gave, the deer partner, Benares. And the reason the deer are smiling is because they realize that his teaching is for the benefit of all sentient beings. Compassion for all sentient beings. So this particular image of the Buddha is one that basically teaches us or reminds us of that connection. That his underlying intention was for the liberation of, for the benefit of all sentient beings. And so you find that phrase over and over again, not just for humans, for all sentient beings. And so it seems a worthwhile image for us to keep before us. You know, any image of the Buddha or Kuan Yin or the Dharma Chakra or anything else is just a reminder, okay, of one of these core teachings. But this is a very useful reminder of this particular realm of teaching. So how was it that we came to this point where we're initiating this two-month series in Earth Sila this evening? Sila is the collective term for three of the eight aspects of the Eightfold Path, those having to do with action in the world. The words we speak, the individual actions that we perform, and basically our way of life. Patterns of our life, how we make our way in the world. In the old sort of 19th century missionary translation, sila is usually translated as morality or ethical conduct, or something along those lines. The Pali scholar Bhikkhu Bodhi said he now prefers the translation harmony, as in living in harmony with. Okay. It's very much attuned, for instance, to the Taoist notions of being attuned to nature, or for that matter, a lot of indigenous peoples. You know, and in Hopi culture, for instance, they speak about the Hopi way. What is the Hopi way? And what they mean is the way that's in harmony. And that's basically what this realm of teaching is all about as well. How do we live in harmony with each other, with our surroundings? So there are various sort of ingredients that seem to come together, you know, in terms of sort of dependent origination, the co-arising of certain factors here that gave rise to us beginning this series this evening. The first one was several months ago, and it was came in the form of a piece of paper handed to me by some members of this Sangha, and it was essentially a request for teachings. And this group within the Sangha is a self-described group calling themselves the Dharma Danes. And they said, following, and the title of their request was Eco-Buddhism's Questions and Issues. Following is a list of some of the reasons we believe we do not get involved in environmental issues. How does Buddhism address these issues? Emotional constraints. How do I overcome my fears? How do I overcome my paralysis? I become overwhelmed with severity and complexity. How do I overcome this? How do I overcome my despair? How do I deal with my cynicism? How do I overcome a sense of futility? How can I move to action? Knowledge constraints. How do I get informed? How do I overcome my ignorance? How do I make choices on what to get involved in? How do I prioritize? How do I recognize what I can do? And then action hindrances. Not enough people are concerned, however, what do I do? Lack of time, lack of energy. What am I not recognizing about myself? What are we for, not just against? How can I get involved if I have physical constraints? How do we communicate our concern to others, including friends and family? And how do I identify best practices? What are the characteristics of best practices? As is the case, as was the case for the Buddha, sometimes when he was asked a wise question, he would pause a while before he answered. So I paused several months. Because these were heavy-duty questions, right? Yeah. Probably on a lot of our minds. And around the same time, I got this group letter from some of my root teachers. And what they were doing was responding to this request for teachings that a Sangha in Great Britain, calling themselves the One Earth Sangha, had said, and they had requested teachings of the Vipassana teachers in Europe and in the United States and North America on the question of environmental crisis. And they were passing that letter along to those of us who also teach Dharma here in the West. And say, well, you know, this has been brought to our attention as something that's really important, and we think we should all start to focus on that. Okay. And then at a recent teacher's reunion retreat that I was on with some of the people I went through my seminary program with, in response to these things, David Chernikoff and I led a little workshop that we called Earth Sila. Living the Buddha's teachings in our environmental relations. You know, and the fifth of the daily recollections, you know, the Buddha taught, you know, it was the recollections about karma. You know, my actions are my relations, my actions are my protection. So what we were doing was drawing attention to entertaining a conversation about, is there a way we can freshen and renew and rebirth our relations with all sentient beings and with the environment itself. Because it was an area that for many of us seemed to have fallen dormant for some of the reasons and the questions that just arose. So, at around this same time as well, since my day job was teaching environmental law and policy, I had been planning to teach a course on energy and the environment, you know, law, policy, and practice, and so on. And in order to be able to do that job ethically and responsibly, it's really important as a teacher to be able to kind of embody or present the articulate all the different policy paths that are being suggested, that are being recommended. What are the rationales underlying them? What's the evidence? How do we proceed from there? And so I started doing a lot of reading from sources that I understood to be balanced and responsible and well-informed, relatively comprehensive, like Daniel Yergin's The Quest, for instance. And as a result of that reading, I decided not to offer the course. The reason that I decided not to offer it is because I came to the conclusion that we are indeed entering into a relatively unprecedented environmental crisis of unknown severity and unknown duration. And there is no way that I could have, in good conscience, have presented the case for continuing to do things as we are. And so that, I guess, for me was sort of, you know, one of the final catalysts to action. My own thoughts and feelings, however, were no different from the Dharma Danes. There are all kinds of disincentives for me to want to get into this area, in part because it's one of the things I do in my day job, and I was really, to some extent, I really kind of try to keep those two personas separate, but I'm failing more and more often. So now I'm just trying to allow them to come together as skillfully and wisely as they can. So what I would actually like to do now is to begin with a little exercise. And what I wish you to please do is take just a moment. You can close your eyes if you want to, because this is a few moments of remembrance and reflection. Remember the last time that you read or heard a story about some aspect of climate change crisis in the news, and then about the failure of governmental institutions to do anything about it. How did it make you feel in your body? What feelings arose for you? Give them a name. What thoughts arose? Okay, oral quiz time. This is my day job, after all. So please, anyone who would like to share in terms of what it felt like in your body, what thoughts arose, or what emotions arose in that experience, please. Or
Well, and I, you know, I've been exploring these feelings for a long time now, and so the, some of the same ones came up. So recently, there was, you know, there was another explosion in the Gulf.
Yes.
Right. I heard nothing except that there was an explosion in the Gulf, and it was like people yawning afterwards. And then the next thing I heard in response to the environment was, it wasn't related, but somebody arguing for the Keystone pipeline. And the two, you know, are maddening. And my first response is always hopelessness.
Yes.
But then there's an immediate response of, and I don't know where that comes from, because I really do feel hopeless, but there's a quickly followed by, I can't not do something.
Yes.
So, you know, I find something else to put in my recycling bag or something.
No. One of the motivating questions that I've come across in my readings that I found very useful in terms of whether, you know, the feeling of despair, hopelessness, or want to simply withdraw or not do anything. At the end of your life, none of us really knows when that's going to be, do you want to be able to say, I did what I could? So when I get down the dumps and feel like I kind of want to pull back a little bit, I find that very helpful. You know, at the end of my life, you know, especially if my children are gathered around, you know, do I want to be able to say, I did what I could, you know, for them? However infinitesimal. So I think, right, that's sort of what you're kind of giving voice to a little bit. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I think that the one that sticks out for me, the story that I read, and I don't remember how recent it was, probably from the last year, it said that there are environmental scientists who believe that by the end of the century that the carrying capacity of the Earth is going to be 1 billion people. And I think about the types of droughts and famines and wars over resources that are going to be required to pare the human race down from, you know, 7 billion plus now and climbing down to 1 billion in the next, you know, 85 years or so. You know, it's like basically that type of, you know, catastrophic, you know, cataclysmic mass death. You know, it's something that I feel like I'm indifferent to it. I mean, it's so mind-blowingly huge. That,
ungraspable.
Yeah, I mean, what, you know, and so, I mean, the place that I tend to go is the, I think it's the closing line of Candide by Voltaire, we must tend our garden.
Right, exactly. So, the feelings that were being, that are being expressed here are, you know, quite common. They're also perfectly natural. I want to explain a couple of the ways that they are. But before going there, I also want to acknowledge the importance of giving voice to the suffering. It's very important. As we all know, you know, as I said over and over again in this tradition, suffering is the gateway to compassion. For ourselves, for each other, for sentient beings, in terms of motivating us to act in a non-dual way, to speak in a non-dual way, getting in touch with our own suffering helps to bring forth the compassionate frame of mind that makes skillful action possible. So, as I've been working on this series for a while, doing a lot of reading, putting these talks together, you know, I've been thinking, well, you know, I've got a pretty good handle on this. I have a vision of where we may want to go and how we may want to do it. And then woke up this morning and started kind of pulling everything together for this talk and just found myself unbelievably depressed. You know, I continue to be no more immune to despair and rage and whatnot than I ever was. It's just that there are other mind states that are kind of bubbling up to the surface as well. And so how to encourage those and not get too bogged down in the others is helpful. It's also helpful to me when I can come across some passage or something that actually gives voice to what it is I'm feeling. And so there's a little poem that I think a lot of you are probably already familiar with by Wendell Berry called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me, and I wake in the night at the least sound, in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. One of the things that Chris Johnstone and Joanna Macy in their book Act of Hope talk a lot about toward the beginning is the essential importance of gratitude, of a feeling of gratitude for all beings in the sentient beings in the world, including the plants in the world, upon whom our survival depends. Okay. So that's kind of what Wendell Berry is doing here. He's expressing gratitude for the healing power of the natural environment. And so for me, likewise, when I'm feeling despair or isolation or a sense of hopelessness, there is something that can be so healing about just going outside, going out and experiencing the environment, you know, the natural environment, and its richness, all that it has to offer, all that it does. You know, back at the beginning, you know, when the little one-celled animals were becoming multi-celled animals, and then at some point after a few million years, some of them figured out how to start doing photosynthesis. Anyway, it happened, right? And as they started figuring out how to do photosynthesis, they started generating, you know, putting a lot of oxygen in the air, the environment, the atmosphere became more and more oxygen rich until finally it was able to support folks like us, right? And they're still doing it. So if we go outside and walk around, please express your gratitude to anything green that you see, okay? Because if it weren't for them, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have any air to breathe, right? They're doing their thing. They're doing their best to capture as much carbon dioxide as they possibly can and to put some oxygen into the air for us to breathe. So thank a tree. It's a good thing.
Hug it.
Yeah, you can hug it. That's good, too. Okay. So, going forward, the first thing that it seems useful to do is to be able to renegotiate our relationship a little bit with our own suffering, our own pain that we feel as a result of the suffering that we see in the world, okay, occasioned by the impacts that, some of the impacts that human behavior are having upon it. So it's a matter of how do we deal with our own little dose of this pain. Pir Velayat Khan, the Sufi leader, let's put it this way. Overcome any bitterness that may have come upon you because you are not up to the magnitude of the pain that was entrusted to you. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each one of us is part of her heart, and therefore endowed with a certain measure of cosmic pain. You are sharing in the totality of that pain, and you are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. Like the mother of the world who carries the pain of the world in her heart, each one of us is a part of her heart, and therefore entrusted with a certain measure of cosmic pain. We are sharing in the totality of that pain, and we are called upon to meet it in joy instead of self-pity. So, whence cometh this pain, you know, in terms of our understanding of the Buddha Dharma and the nature of consciousness? Helps if we go back and look at some of these teachings about the nature of mindfulness itself, and also the importance of working with these difficult mind states in a way that transforms them. The leader of Cambodian Buddhism, Maha Gosananda, after the Khmer Rouge overran his country and began slaughtering people, starting with the monks and nuns. And people were fleeing across the borders out of Cambodia into Thailand and elsewhere. And he was setting up refugee camps. He worked for years ministering to the needs of those who were fleeing the Khmer Rouge. And he was asked many years later in the 1990s, an award ceremony for him, where he received acknowledgement for all he had done to alleviate the suffering of his countrymen and women. And he was asked how he managed to do that, how he managed to not succumb to the rage and the depression and the utter despair that he saw his people going through. And he said, throughout that period of time, I was making peace with myself. I was making peace with myself. Because he had to be able to make peace with himself before he could make peace with the world. When Thich Nhat Hanh first came here in the late 1960s, early 70s, and was asked to come around the country and speak at anti-war rallies and whatnot, there was a lot of excitement, you know, because he was a kind of the moral leader of trying to bring the war going in Vietnam until they kicked him out or wouldn't let him go back in. And so he'd go around and he'd speak these places where he is invited, and for the most part, this big flock. And the reason is because the message he would consistently give when he'd get up there was to say, you have a real problem in this country. The problem that you have is that you have an anti-war movement. What you need is a peace movement. And so some of us who heeded his words tried to do that. The problem, of course, being that we were trying to conduct a peace movement at the same time and place that others were trying to conduct an anti-war movement. And so it led to a lot of dissension about where to go from here. And one member of our Sangha, when I told him this story, said, oh, I think I get it. What we're about is trying to start an environmental peace movement. And I think that has a lot of merit, actually, you know. Because the peace movement was more than just trying to bring the war in Vietnam to an end. It was about exploring the sources that made the war start in the first place. And there, in fact, was an organization that flowed out of that called Beyond War. You know, trying to imagine and bring into being a world beyond war. And so, in this same way, you know, the only misgiving I had about that request for teachings letter that went out from, you know, my own root teachers was it seemed to be in response to the environmental crisis, right? And so in some ways for me, the climate change crisis is not the end in and of itself. It's more a symptom than the It's like if you had a loved one who was running a very high fever that was not controllable. It's basically a symptom of an increasingly serious condition having to do with the nature of the way that we collectively, all of us, you know, inhabit the planet. Right? And that making environmental peace is a lot more than just trying to solve the problem of global warming. It can happen along the way. And there are various scenarios under which it might. But what I think we're really looking at instead is a much more fundamental rethinking of what exactly is the nature of our relationship with other sentient beings. How do we distinguish between wants and needs? More specifically tonight, the realm of environmental communication. How do we decide, you know, one of the books I recommended for here is a little book by Clay Johnson called The Information Diet. You know, this is the phrase, you are what you eat. What he's saying, essentially, is you think what you've ingested, right? That where you go for information about these matters, the impact that that information has upon you conditions your thoughts in the way that you look at the world. So if you think about, you know, the four means of establishing mindfulness, you know, mindfulness of the body and the sensory apparatus, how do we take in knowledge of the world? That's why the Buddha taught the four elements meditation, and that's why we did it this evening, to better attune ourselves to taking in information about the nature of the world around us through the way we experience it in our bodies. Noting whether sensory input is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Connecting input with memories of past experiences of the same input, experiences that dealing with both the pleasant and the unpleasant, examining the ways our perception and understanding of experience may be co-creating dissatisfaction with other sentient beings and what needs to be done about it. So, Rick Hansen, in his book, Buddha's Brain, says, you know, we're hardwired as a matter of survival when we're scanning the environment for information. We are first and foremost attuned to recognize potential threats and then potential opportunities. So the fact that we feel the kind of despair that we do, the kind of hopelessness, right, has got a great deal to do with how the mind is hardwired to work. We read in the news and we see, boy, there's some really horrible things going on out there, right? And we tend to focus on those, you know, not even the beneficial things that are happening while we're trying to heal the environment or other ways that things might also be moving at the same time. We tend to focus on the threatening information and how it might pose a threat to our civilization, our species, our communities, our nation. Okay. And then especially if alongside those messages of threat and warning, we also get messages of institutional incapacity, right? The inability of the institutions of governments or the market or anything else to seeming to be able to do very much kind of creative about it. I mean, it's really no wonder that we find ourselves feeling the kind of despair that we do, feeling the kind of disinclination to get involved. In part because, as good yogis, we know that if that's the mind state, if I'm feeling despair, if I'm feeling rage, if I give voice to those feelings, okay, it won't be skillful. That I need to be able to be in a frame of mind that allows me to see things in a non-dual way, that allows me to perceive the possibility of a more positive future and how we might get there before I enter into the discourse, which is very wise, right? What's the Buddha's checklist for skillful speech? Is it beneficially intended? Is it useful? Truthful? Timely and kind. Pretty tall order of what you're mostly feeling is rage and despair. Well, if Clay Johnson is right, and we think what we read is right, it may be worth taking a moment for us to just sit and reflect upon what does our information diet consist of. Where do you get your information about environmental affairs? Let's take just a moment once again. Settle in. Allow the eyes to close if you wish to. Reflect for a moment on what are your primary sources of information about environmental affairs. What are your information consumption patterns? What does your information diet consist of? Do you actively seek out a variety of information, or do you passively receive whatever the news media provides? What are your sources of information about your environment? So, what kind of information have you been eating lately? Where does it come to you from? Please.
New York Times, New Yorker,
pretty much.
And if I want to look up if there's a reference that I want to follow up.
Yes.
And I would read books that are written by scientists for a general audience.
Yes, okay, good.
And I saw a movie that was made in Boulder, Chasing Ice, if we're talking about the environment, so that's another sort of thing.
Chasing Ice.
It's wonderful.
Okay.
This was somebody who decided he was going to do something about the environment, and he went and measured a very complicated process, the melting of the glaciers and how fast that was. That was a beautiful
okay.
I recommend it to anybody.
Thank you. Others, please, where do you get your environmental information from?
NPR.
Okay, public broadcasting, yes?
I get probably 24 emails a day from different organizations. From the Sierra Club, the Physicians for Social Responsibility, about actions and issues, and some of them I research and follow up on. And go to their website and read. And it's kind of, like, honestly, it's like, how do I take that in some days when I can't?
Yes.
I just delete.
Yep. Okay.
But
I'm
trying to learn as much as I can from that.
Thank you. Yes, please, Ian.
I guess I'm an ostrich because I choose to get no information.
Yes. And you have to stop and think for a moment about whether there may be a certain degree of wisdom there insofar as one's mental health is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it feels like just too much every once in a while, you know, maybe you just got to stop eating anything. Go on a news fast. That's one of the things I love about going on vacation. Try to just avoid the news media for a while. Yes, please.
Well, sort of following up on that comment that was just made several years ago, you know, I came out of a seminar and saw Bunker Sticker that said, if you're not completely appalled, you're not paying attention. And I thought, that's right. I am completely appalled, and I kind of started this internal rant. And then I realized it wasn't really getting me anywhere positive. And so I did really take on very long newscasts that still exist. And I'm realizing as you're asking this question, where am I getting my information? One of the sources is going outside and direct observation myself.
Yes.
Not that I can see every part of the world, but it does at least help me get in touch with being grateful.
Yes, thank you. Another point that Clay Johnson makes in his book is about analogizing processed information to processed food. Most of the information we get, you know, whether it's through print news media, broadcast, is highly processed. Okay, there are field reporters out there putting together a story, gathering facts. They write something up, it goes to their editors, they decide whether it's going to go in at all, and if so, how it's going to be placed and whatnot. And by the time we get it, it's like stuff made out of refined white flour and sugar, right? Because it's been through all these filtering processes before we get it. So trying to get back a little closer to original sources certainly has something to recommend it, but it's an art form and it takes a certain amount of effort, right? Yeah, Don.
Let me just play the devil's advocate for a minute here. But has anyone been following the Denver Post letters to the editor section? There's been a sort of ongoing debate about where people are getting their information about global warming. And it's kind of interesting to me because it's obvious that there are some quite intelligent people who have taken the opposite side that I take.
Yes.
You know, I take the side that human activity is involved in the warming of the planet.
Right.
And that it is settled science. But some quite well-spoken people have been writing in saying, wait a minute, it isn't settled science, and science is never settled. And so, for me, what if nothing else, what it's doing for me in reading these letters is sort of promoting a little bit of tolerance that I didn't have before. You know, I mean, the willingness to acknowledge that maybe I don't know everything.
Yes. Yes.
And maybe that's a good place to start. I mean, why not start from our side, acknowledging that the other side might have a point?
Yes. Course, trying to get it, again, to get away from the kind of dualistic perspective
exactly.
on things. There are two concepts in Johnson's book that I also commend to you. One is called epistemic closure. And what that refers to is enclosing in terms of the perimeter or the parameters of your sources of information, tending only to refer to those sources with which you agree.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And commentators and others who agree with you. And so what happens as a result of epistemic closure is the creation of what's called an epistemic bubble. And none of us are immune from it. And to an extent, it's useful to understand why that's happened and why there may even be some benefits to it. The reason is because if you're feeling hopeless and isolated, I'm all alone, there's nothing I can do, if you happen to be in contact with others who may feel that way, but who say, you know, I'm going to do something about this, or at least to have somebody else to grouse with, you know, at least there can be that some sense of community, even if it's a community of people who are hurting and are feeling seriously stressed, a little bit like, you know, people grieving the loss of a common friend or something like that, right? So to some extent, it can provide that function. However, it also can really limit our ability to exercise our intelligence. Okay. Another concept, really useful, I've found out of his book, however, is something called agnotology. Agnotology means the deliberate creation of doubt, where perhaps none previously existed. Okay. ExxonMobil spent $160 million funding any research to come to the conclusion that global warming is not really happening, or that human beings are not the primary contributors to it. Okay. And so this stage of the game, we got 97% of the scientists in the world who are saying it's here, we cause it, it's worse than we thought. And then there's a small number who say no. It doesn't mean that all those who say no are on the take from ExxonMobil. You know, George Miller, I think his name was a physicist at UC Berkeley. And until actually quite recently, he was probably the most articulate and most highly regarded spokesperson for the skeptics, you know. And the general view is, you know, you can have the majority of a scientific community believe in one thing, and they'll try to squelch, you know, any opposing views from the journals and whatnot, because it challenges the established orthodoxy and also challenges all the research grants that the people get that are editing the journals. But the way science works best, even if you've got what you think to be consensus, if there's a responsible skeptical voice that's saying, hey, wait a minute, this is what he was doing, there's some holes in the data, plus I think you're cherry-picking the data, and there are just some real problems with your methodology. And so he complained about that for years, had the effect of basically improving the science. And then he went back and did his own studies that looked, just tracked two things, one temperature and the other CO2 buildup. And he came out on the internet a few weeks ago and said, not only is it happening, we're causing it, almost all of it ourselves, and it's much worse than we thought. And we better big now. So, but he performed this really valuable function for a long time. Okay. And in order to keep the scientific community on this, you need to have that skeptic. You need to have that kind of sea anchor that tries to keep things lined up a little bit. So absolutely, you know, to simply dismiss those with whom we don't agree, okay, impugning their motives or whatever, not so helpful. Not so helpful. Yeah, please.
I guess, like you said, I'm not an environmental scientist, so I don't know if it's occurring or not, but I feel like if it is, the consequences are so severe that it's important, you know, for me to pay attention and do what I can on the possibility of it. Mm-hmm. And I also notice over the decades, I don't like air conditioning. I have a townhouse that doesn't have very good built-in ventilation. I hardly ever used it. Use it just once in a while on those really hot days. Now I notice that, you know, my internal air conditioning will not work.
It's getting hotter.
Yeah, it's true.
Please.
I'm glad that someone mentioned going outside, because I've been lucky enough to live in the same area all my life, and it's obvious things are changing. But there's also stepping outside of I don't have a TV. I do limit how much, just the flow of information. But I check stories on BBC or Al Jazeera or from other places, mm-hmm, to see what they're reporting. And also, I mean, I can't do it all the time, certainly, but like to go to the mining companies' websites and see, mm-hmm, what they're reporting as far as what's happening with this situation and wherever versus what I'm hearing from news reports and what the, you know, Environmental Defense Fund is saying, and just to kind of do some comparing on what's being said and how it's being presented, and to try and, I mean, my bias is definitely still in place, but at least it opens the door a little bit to get a more balanced view.
Right. Getting a more balanced view, having a more varied information diet, okay, These are things that we can each, you know, seek to do on our own. Some of us do. However, sometimes it's much more easily done in groups. There is an organization, it's affiliated with Gil Fronsdale's Sangha at Redwood City. It's called the Buddhist Insight Network. And I've been working with Kim Allen, the editor of the website. And what we're doing is we're in the process of creating an environmental presence on the Buddhist Insight Network website in the general realm of living the Buddhist teachings and our environmental relations. And one of the things that we thought was going to be most important to do first was to set up several different categories of information repository, which is to say, one could be a listing of sites to go to for trustworthy information. Another, knowing about other organizations among Buddha Dharma Sanghas, all the Buddha Sanghas and all the traditions, and having those available to us. Having places where we can go to find literature, Dharma talks, reading lists, whatnot. We're in the process of putting that together right now. We've finalized, I think, the information categories we want. What I'm going to be doing on the listserv over the next few days is putting out that list of information categories. Then anyone who wishes to can tell me what you think about the list and if it should be adjusted in some ways. And then once we have that established, then we're going to set up a process for gathering that information, posting it on the website, so we'll all have a place to go to do the kind of thing we're talking about here. Looking for wider variety. Yes, please.
I look at scientific journals, Daily Grist, the Concerned Scientists information. I'm on two national listservs, energy listservs. Mm-hmm. One anti-nuclear, one just general energy mm-hmm. listserv. But you also wanted to say that when you ask the first question, my kind of first thing that comes up is, come on, people, there aren't enough. There aren't enough people and there aren't enough good connections between people to reverse this in a reasonable period of time. And we need to get going. You know, it's like, come on, let's get going kind of that attitude or response to it.
And certainly where Joanna and Chris are coming from in Active Hope is basically if you've gotten to the point where it's not going to really be possible to count on governmental institutions to do anything meaningful in the short term, we basically got to start doing it ourselves. And then one of the ways you do that is to find out what else is going on out there, who's doing it, is there a part or a role that we want to play. And so that's kind of what we're building from here, you know, including our own speech going forward in terms of the Buddhist checklist, you know, to see if it's actually possible for us to do that practice as we go. So I warned everybody in the flyer that there would probably be some music, and so we're going to go ahead and have some now. And the reason that I like to do this is for the same reason that the Beatles ended their movie Yellow Submarine as they did. They said, you know, when you get to a certain point, all you can really do is go out singing. As well as, in my experience, it's also a way to remember that we are, in fact, in this together. Music sometimes is a pretty good way of doing that, remembering that. So, up off the coast of Maine, Acadia National Park, there's an island. It's called Isla Ho. Okay. And it's favored by fishermen and other boaters who happen to be out on rough seas because it's tall enough and it's broad enough that no matter how rough it's blowing, if you get around on the lee side, it's a safe harbor, place of sanctuary, place to get out of the rough weather. And so Gordon Bach wrote this song about 40, 50 years ago. He was trying to capture the time when fishing was still done under sail. And so the chorus to it, which we can sing together, is "We'll haul down the sails where the bays come together, hide away the day by the hills of Idaho." Let's try it together. "We'll haul down the sails where the bays come together, hide away the day. Coming together in refuge and sanctuary. Well, away to the westward, there's a place where you can go. Where the fishing's always easy, and there ain't no ice and snow. So we'll haul down the sails where the bays come together. Have a good week.